Hitting record. This is Kenny Wade, and I'm with Franklin Cook, and we're in room 207. And we're going to have a conversation about a lot of different things, but most of it just has to do with life and journey and being a part of the mission of God through the Nazarene Church. Franklin, you told me a few times, a couple times we've talked about the start of the work of the church in Russia. Tell me that story again from the beginning.
Well, first of all, we need to remember that Russia was part of the Soviet Union. And if you go back historically to the beginning, you've got to frame the opening of our work in Russia against the backdrop of decades of competition in a bipolar world between the West and the Soviet Empire. So there's a lot of ideology and a lot of military issues involved. Most people would say that we were their enemy. They were our enemy. And of course, in their system, which was a closed system, there was a total lack of communication for the average citizen from the outside world. Mm-hmm. So the Church of the Nazarene, along with most Protestant denominations, had no presence at all in that whole part of the world, the whole Soviet Empire,
yeah.
Or in fact in Eastern Europe also. So in 1989, 1990, 1991, when Mr. Gorbachev came into power in Russia, he saw that things were changing and developed a new philosophy. Most people called it glasnost, which is the Russian word for openness. Mm. And the idea was, and the risk he took, was that they needed to start communicating with other nations and allowing people to travel and allowing people to listen to the radio or television, Western programs and all of that. Well, this was a dramatic change in the whole structure. Right. Well, as part of that process, a lot of groups from the West, predominantly from North America at the time, began to go into Russia and connect, usually through universities or university students. And in fact, that's how the Nazarenes began. Groups of students came from several of our colleges and universities, Point Loma being one example, through their Love Works program that was one of the finest programs that any of our schools put together, and began to connect with university students in the city of Moscow. Well, one thing led to another, and the farther we went along with the process, the more it became obvious that if we actually were going to start work of the church as a church in Russia, there was things we needed to do. And I was the regional director at the time, so that was part of my territory. And so I had to take on the responsibility of thinking about what we were going to do, how we were going to do it, when we were going to do it, and with whom we were going to do it. And it didn't take long for me to begin to figure out that we needed to have some permanent people under contract there that could provide continuity and stability and begin to pull the various strands of activity that were going on together in some kind of a coordinated process, which would lead ultimately to the organization of a church and the developing of leaders and so on and so forth. So there was a period of time before we had anybody in place in Moscow where I was going back and forth almost monthly, having meetings with different people.
From where were you going back and forth from?
Germany, okay. where I lived and where the office was.
Which city in Germany was that?
Well, it was actually near Zurich, Switzerland, but it's kind of on the border of Switzerland and Germany.
Okay.
So, now, put that all aside for a minute. When Joseph Stalin was in power in Russia, and he was dictator for close to 30 years, very ruthless, and of course the official position of the government was atheism. So they did everything they could to kill the Christian influence in church. They closed all of the Orthodox monasteries with the exception of four, and they took all of the other religious organizations of any kind, historical, way back, and dumped them into one organization and claimed that now all of these members, whether they were Pentecostal or Wesleyan or Calvinist, or didn't matter, Catholic, didn't matter, under something, they call it the Russian Baptist Union.
Mm.
So the Russian Baptists, which weren't Baptists at all, had an office, and they were the official registered body with the government, with the Ministry of Cults and Religions.
The Ministry of Cults and Religions.
Yeah, something like that. I'm not sure that was totally the correct.
It's got a nice ring to it.
Title, but that's who you had to deal with to get any legal standing.
Yeah.
So those are the folks that I met with over and over again. In Moscow. And I don't want to say too much about them because there was a lot of stuff that was going on under the table over the years, and so we had to watch what we were doing. But nonetheless, that's who we met with, and that's whose umbrella we slipped under in that kind of interim period.
Yep.
Which was, I can't overemphasize the chaos of the whole system at the time. Currency, the ruble went to pieces, all of the government offices were changing. I met with this minister of cults, and I asked him what to me was a logical question in one meeting, which was, if we put people here, what kind of visa do they need? And what kind of work permit? And he nearly fell off of his chair laughing. He said, I've never been asked by anybody how to come into Russia. I've always been asked, how do I leave Russia?
Wow.
So he said, we have no standards. And he said, besides, in another 2 or 3 months, I won't have a job.
What year is that?
Oh, it's probably 1990.
Yep.
So that was the situation, and through a process, we finally identified and sent Chuck and Carla Sundberg as really the pioneering missionaries for the Church of the Nazarene into Russia, and they established themselves in the city of Moscow. Now, once they were there, we began to get a lot of volunteers and people that came to help in one way or another with the work projects and all kinds of stuff. And so That's fundamentally how we got started in Russia.
Okay.
Now, one little side point is, once Chuck and Carla had been there for a while, I said to them, we need a strategy. And so I began to talk to them and about how we were going to develop an actual strategy for the future. And through the help of some consultants and other assistants, developed a strategy where the idea would be to start ministry centers in 5 of the leading cities. Then the next question, of course, is how are we going to pay for this? And so we began to develop. Chuck, I remember one day, said to me, I need $5 million. Well, of course, I knew that the resources of the church, there was absolutely no possibility that we were going to come up with $5 million. So we developed, out of that came the idea of the partnership programs, where we would get groups of people, businessmen and others, involved in raising funding for the development of these ministry centers. And fundamentally, at its heart, that became our strategy then.
So let me ask you, this is a bit of a diverging question from the USSR and Russia specifically, but with this partnerships question, on conversations I have with people, district, local, district, field, region, the question is, why doesn't the general church just fund young adults being involved in mission? But then anytime I have conversation with those that are in leadership within the church, it's very apparent to me, if we're going to fund these things, it's going to have to be outside of the current giving structure, WEF structure, tithes and offering structure. So what I'm wondering is if there's a connection to today in that conversation and the 1990s, with partnerships having to happen in this pioneering work and activity in these ministry centers, and you need to find funds, partnerships, and business folks. What's the correlation from the 1990s to right now, and why those outside partnerships are necessary to fund mission?
Well, to start that conversation, you got to go back to 1923.
Let's do it. Time warp.
When the Church of the Nazarene was formed from 4 major groups who came together in a union, each of these groups had their own funding mechanism.
What were those 4 groups?
Oh.
I'll put you on the spot. We can come back to that.
Yeah, I don't. I can't. There's
4 groups.
Yeah, 4 major groups. Some of them in the South, some of them in the New England area, and one of them in the West.
Uh-huh.
But you'd have to go back to the history of the Church of the Nazarene to get the details.
I'll do my homework.
So you get these groups merging in 1908 officially.
Right.
But they all had their own funding mechanism, and they all had their own mission groups. They were sending missionaries. They were funding missionaries. They had orphanages. They had medical work. They had all kinds of stuff going on. So as things evolved between 1908 and 1923, you had the Board of Missions, you had the Board of Home Missions, you had the Board of Sunday School, you had the Board of this and Board of that and Board of the other, all trying to raise money to do their ministry. So you had the whole publishing industry, or the publishing concerns, where they were trying to produce holiness materials and stuff like that. So in 1923, they took a decision to bring all that together under what was called the General Board, and to create something called the General Budget. And the General Budget is now called World Evangelism Fund. So centralizing the whole funding mechanism. But in those years, the allocation of the money that was received was primarily, or at least largely, for mission, not for administration. And so over time, they found it necessary to start other funds, for example, with the radio ministry. And so they had to take special offerings to support World Mission Radio, which became communications later on, and different ministries of the church. So even from the beginning, with a central budget, like a general budget or World Evangelism Fund, there were other ministry needs for which offerings were received and funds were raised, but not through a partnership concept. The partnership concept came later. And I think probably the one we formed for the Soviet Union and for Russia was sort of the first one that where there was a formal structure put together on how to run a partnership. And then later, many other partnerships were started to support specific ministries.
Okay.
So, I don't know that that's the answer, but...
No, that's...
That's just kind of an old...
That's helpful to me. I'm sure that's helpful to somebody else as well. I'm going
to... But yep. To get to your original question on this, which was why can't the church fund people who want to...
Everything we're doing through the World Evangelism Fund.
Well...
Because churches are giving towards that, and districts are giving towards that, and we're giving towards our schools and everything.
Because our growth has outpaced giving. The more you grow, the more need you have. And we've gone through a period where we've made a big priority of opening work in new countries. I forget what number we're at right at the moment. But we've opened work in a lot of new countries.
It's like 160.
Yeah, think about it. We just don't have the funds, which can cover the needs that would be represented in that many countries. So, you know, from a businessman's point of view, you'd say we're overextended. But from a spiritual point of view, you'd say you always want to be overextended.
Mm.
I mean, it's not a business. We're not in a business. We're in a church. So there's a faith element and a trust element and all of that that's involved. So.
Thank you. I'm going to stop us here with Russia as the beginning point and partnerships as the ending point. And then come back to another topic later.
Okay.
So thanks, Franklin.
Yes, sir.